Who is the enemy? It depends on who you ask.
Name the enemy.
Target and take out our common enemy.
This is where you separate the enemy from the people.
That old Beach Boys song, Bomberan.
We shall never completely understand the Japanese mind. But then, they don't understand ours either.
And so an iron curtain fell across Europe.
By the end of the weekend, more Americans will have been killed by Mexicans than by ISIS or by sharks.
I think Islam hates us.
Super predators. No conscience, no empathy.
Public enemy number one is drug abuse.
Number one enemy we probably have on the globe, Vladimir Putin.
I call the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are.
And their refusal to identify the enemy is putting you, the American people, at risk.
Our enemies believed America was weak.
Well, it's fair to say ISIS is nothing compared to MS-13.
You wouldn't believe how bad these people are. These aren't people. These are animals.
There's a tremendous hatred. We have to get to the bottom of it.
Throughout history, leaders have rallied this country against particular groups in the name of national security. And while who our enemy is has changed over time, one thing is constant. Leaders telling us it's us versus them. For President Trump, MS-13 has been a justification for his law and order approach since the campaign. But should this group be considered the enemy? Today, we separate fact from fiction around La Mara Salvatrucha. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Fear of the other is nothing new, of course, especially in the context of national security.
The idea is not the product of events. It's the product of a kind of campaign that gets launched by special interests to popularize these ideas for their own particular agendas.
That's Arun Kunani, visiting assistant professor at NYU's Department of Media, Culture, and Communications. And he says MS-13 is the latest American boogeyman, and the data backs that up. A poll released this week by HuffPost and YouGov looked at voters' perceptions of MS-13, and the results show a partisan divide in perceptions on the gang. It says 85% of Trump voters say MS-13 is a serious threat to the United States, and that immigration policy should be changed to combat the gang. 32% of voters who supported Hillary Clinton in 2016 would say the same. But is that fear warranted? NYU's Arun Kunani joined me in studio along with Hannah Dreyer, a reporter covering immigration for ProPublica, who's been reporting on MS-13 for a year.
This is a gang that I don't think most people knew even existed in the United States a couple years ago. And it's a gang that's not growing. So MS-13 was founded in the U.S. It's been here since the 80s. It's been about the same size, 10,000 people, for more than a decade. So I'm reporting on Long Island all the time, and I go into the communities that are the most terrorized by MS-13. And even there, I feel pretty safe because I know that this gang mostly targets a very specific community, mostly immigrant teenagers who are targets for recruitment or who are seen as members of rival gangs. I mean, MS-13 really is a threat and really is vicious for this small community in a couple of places across the country. But it seems like voters are getting this idea that the gang is everywhere and the gang could be showing up on their front lawn.
And we also don't seem to talk about, we're very specific in which groups we choose to target. And I think this has been a historical American issue, right? We've seen mass shootings over the past couple of years that have been involved white men. Arun, I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about the history behind some of this, like how people, different groups of people, Japanese, Muslim, Central American migrants, how have these different groups been used as scapegoats?
Well, if you look specifically, for example, at the way that we have talked about Muslims, right? So right now, at least a couple of decades, we've had this idea of the kind of Muslim fanatic who's inherently violent and especially prone to terrorism and so forth, right? So what's interesting about that idea is that you see that emerge before 9/11. It's not a product of 9/11. It actually emerges around about the 70s and 80s before there's actually been acts of terrorism committed by Muslims in the United States, right? So the idea is not the product of events. It's the product of a kind of campaign that gets launched by special interests to popularize these ideas for their own particular agendas. And then 9/11 accelerates that, intensifies that. After 9/11, we see hundreds of millions of dollars being spent by various foundations and think tanks to kind of popularize this idea that Muslims are just inherently dangerous.
And when you say money being spent by think tanks to popularize this idea, how are they doing that? Are they spending it on research?
What they're doing is a number of things. They're putting out videos online continuously. They are building mass movements. There are Islamophobic networks that have hundreds of thousands of active members in the United States, kind of rivaling the NRA in terms of their kind of level of activism, lobbying in DC, trying to pass legislation, campaigning at the state level. I mean, it's not a grassroots movement, it's a top-down movement with huge amounts of money to try and drive this kind of idea through the United States. And then what happens is that someone like Trump can come along in 2016 and, you know, just needs to say two words: we're going to do a Muslim ban. And, you know, all of this reservoir of sentiment that's been built up over a couple of decades gets mobilized to drive into the White House.
And Hannah, you mentioned this is a group that's been around for a couple of decades now. I mean, there are other groups in the United States. MS-13 is not the only dangerous group of individuals in the country. There are other hate groups. The KKK is still in existence, the Bloods and the Crips. And I mean, we can go on with other gang networks and other types of hate groups that are watched, you know, and listed by a lot of nonprofits. So why this group in particular?
I mean, I think that's exactly right about these other groups. MS-13 is not the biggest gang in the U.S. It's not the fastest growing. It's not the most violent. It doesn't have the most businesses. It doesn't have the highest body count. There's no reason that we would be talking about this gang right now, except that it's the gang in the U.S. most strongly associated with Central America.
Which is now our current target, because we're talking about how this target keeps shifting, right, every couple of decades. So now our current target is Central America.
Exactly. And mm-hmm. if you want to preach a message of closed borders and talk about how bad it is that Central American asylum seekers are coming to the U.S., this is the gang that you would pick to talk about. And I think the biggest misconception right now is that MS-13 is some kind of global cartel or global threat on par with ISIS. It's not a gang with global ambitions. It's a gang composed of small cliques of maybe two dozen people, mostly teenagers and young men who hang out in the woods outside of DC and outside of New York and smoke marijuana and drink juice and talk about, you know, girls they have crushes on, and then occasionally go out and commit spectacular violence. But that violence is really committed for its own sake. It's not violence committed with any larger aim, like foiling the laws about who can come into this country, or even, I don't know, making a drug deal. It's a gang composed of small groups. It's mostly disorganized. And it's not the major gang in this country.
When you're talking to victims, Hannah, do they agree with the president's approach?
Yeah, so Trump calls these families angel families, and he has focused especially on two families on Long Island, the families of these two girls who were killed on their way home from high school in 2016. And those are the two families of all the victims on Long Island who are not immigrants. The other families are immigrant families, and when I talk to them, they seem pretty ambivalent. I followed the mother of one 15-year-old boy who was killed on Long Island to a Trump rally earlier this summer, and she sort of drifted between the pro-Trump rally and the counter-protest, and she wasn't sure where she wanted to settle because she really wants justice for her son who was killed. And she wants this gang to be gotten rid of. So she's hoping that Trump does something that helps her. But she also was very wary of the rhetoric about immigrants because she is an immigrant and she feels threatened herself. And I think what the families really want, what they tell me they want, is local law enforcement reaction to the gang. And it doesn't have a lot to do with this national rhetoric that we hear from Trump. But the families are pragmatic. I mean, the families who I talk to, and I've talked to most of the families of the victims on Long Island, they just want justice for their kids. They don't want the gang to be in their community. And they seem sort of fine with being made into political pawns so long as those things happen. And so far, it doesn't seem like they feel safer. Local law enforcement doesn't seem to be making meaningful progress. And so with this mother of the 15-year-old at the Trump rally, she seemed really upset, and she ended the day crying and taking anti-anxiety pills and just sort of retreating.
Is there the potential for, and this may be a stretch, I want to put it out there as a hypothetical, but is there the potential for seeing the way the administration is treating migrants from Central America into the United States, for seeing the way the administration is demonizing MS-13, for young Latino boys in particular to say, you know what, radicalize in some way because of the frustration of being painted as the other, of constantly feeling as though they're being demonized to begin with, right? Do we run the risk of radicalizing in some ways young Latino men who might be not interested in MS-13, but suddenly don't feel that they have a place in the United States either?
Yeah, I mean, I think the key word here is vulnerable. People who've studied this gang in Central America and in the U.S. say that people join MS-13 for a sense of belonging. It's not like a normal gang that you might join to make money or for protection. And the kids who I've talked to who've joined the gang or come in contact with the gang say that the gang felt like family to them, and they felt strong when they were there. And a lot of these kids are coming up and feel alienated in the U.S. They come here, they don't speak the language, their parents are usually working a lot, and they feel alone, sort of like any teenager. It's just normal teenage alienation, plus language barriers, and the gang exploits that. So the more teenagers feel vulnerable and the more they feel cut off, I think the more successful MS-13 is going to be.
What do you think is the end game from the administration's perspective here with MS-13? Like, what do you think is the goal? Is it just to rally the base, or is there more to it?
It's hard to know what the administration is trying to do, but the effect of the administration's rhetoric so far seems to have been to sow a lot of fear across the country of a gang that just does not exist in a meaningful way across most of the country. And I think all of this matters because there are some families who have been terribly victimized by the gang. And they're not a lot, but, you know, there's dozens of families that have lost loved ones and are never going to be the same and desperately want to see this gang crack down on. And the rhetoric that we're hearing right now about borders, about a national threat, is just not in sync with what's really happening on the ground. And that makes it so hard to enact meaningful policy.
Hannah Dreyer is a reporter for ProPublica, and Arun Kundani is a professor at NYU. Hannah, Arun, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.